like Jews persecuted Jews who looked like Aryans, and Jews persecuted their debtors, where every statesman and clergyman praised peace and brightly asserted that the only way to get peace was to get ready for war. What conceivable reason could one have for seeking after righteousness in a world which so hated righteousness? Why do anything except eat and read and make love and provide for sleep that should be secure against disturbance by armed policemen? He never did find any particularly good reason. He simply went on. In June, when the Fort Beulah cell of the new underground had been carrying on for some 3 months, Mr. Francis Tasbro, the golden quarryman, called on his neighbor, Doremus. "How are you, Frank?"
"Fine, Remus. How's the old carping critic?"
"Fine, Frank. Still carping. Fine carping weather at that. Have a cigar?"
"Thanks. Got a match?" "Thanks. Saw Sissy yesterday. She looks fine."
"Yes, she's fine. I saw Malcolm driving by yesterday. How did he like it in the Provincial University at New York?"
"Oh, fine, fine. He says the athletics are grand. They're getting Primo Carnera over to coach in tennis next year. I think it's Carnera. I think it's tennis. But anyway, the athletics are fine there, Malcolm says. Say, Remus, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. The fact is, I want you to be sure and not repeat this to anybody. I know you can be trusted with a secret, even if you are a newspaper man. Or used to be, I mean, but the fact is, and this is inside stuff, official, there's going to be some governmental promotions all along the line. This is confidential, and it comes to me straight from the provincial commissioner, Colonel Hake. Luthorn is finished as Secretary of War. He's a nice fellow, but he hasn't got as much publicity for the corpos out of his office as the chief expected him to. Hake is to have his job and also take over the position of High Marshal of the Minutemen from Lee Saracen. I suppose Saracen has too much to do. Well, then, John Sullivan Reek is slated to be provincial commissioner. That leaves the office of district commissioner for Vermont, New Hampshire, empty. And I'm one of the people being seriously considered. I've done a lot of speaking for the corpos, and I know Dewey Hake very well. I was able to advise him about erecting public buildings. Of course, there's none of the county commissioners around here that measure up to a district commissionership. Not even Dr. Staubmeyer. Certainly not Shad Ledoux. Now, if you could see your way clear to throw in with me, your influence would help."
"Good heavens, Frank, the worst thing you could have happen if you want the job is to have me favor you. The corpos don't like me. Oh, of course they know I'm loyal, not one of those dirty, sneaking anti-corpos, but I never made enough noise in the paper to please 'em."
"That's just it, Remus. I've got a really striking idea. Even if they don't like you, the corpos respect you, and they know how long you've been important in the state. We'd all be greatly pleased if you came out and joined us. Now, just suppose you did so and let people know that it was my influence that converted you to corpoism. That might give me quite a leg up. And between old friends like us, Remus, I can tell you that this job of district commissioner would be useful to me in the quarry business, aside from the social advantages. And if I got the position, I can promise you that I'd either get the informer taken away from Staubmeyer and that dirty little stinker Itchett, and given back to you to run absolutely as you pleased. Providing, of course, you had the sense to keep from criticizing the chief and the state. Or, if you'd rather, I think I could probably wangle a job for you as military judge. They don't necessarily have to be lawyers. Or maybe President Peasley's job as district director of education. You'd have a lot of fun out of that. Awfully amusing the way all the teachers kiss the director's foot. Now come on, old man. Think of all the fun we used to have in the old days. Come to your senses and face the inevitable and join us and fix up some good publicity for me. How about it, huh? Huh?"
Doremus reflected that the worst trial of a revolutionary propagandist was not risking his life, but having to be civil to people like future Commissioner Tasbro. He supposed that his voice was polite as he muttered, "Afraid I'm too old to try it, Frank." But apparently Tasbro was offended. He sprang up and tramped away, grumbling, "All very well, then." And I didn't give him a chance to say anything about being realistic or breaking eggs to make an omelet, regretted Doremus. The next day, Malcolm Tasbro, meeting Sissy on the street, made his beefy most of cutting her. At the time, the Jessops thought that was very amusing. They thought the occasion less amusing when Malcolm chased little David out of the Tasbro apple orchard, which he had been wont to use as the great western forest where at any time one was rather more than likely to meet Kit Carson, Robin Hood, and Colonel Lindbergh hunting together. Having only Frank's word for it, Doremus could do no more than hint in Vermont vigilance that Colonel Dewey Hake was to be made Secretary of War and give Hake's actual military record, which included the facts that, as a first lieutenant in France in 1918, he had been under fire for less than 15 minutes, and that his one real triumph had been commanding state militia during a strike in Oregon, when 11 strikers had been shot down, 5 of them in the back. Then Doremus forgot Tasbro completely and happily. Chapter 30. But worse than having to be civil to the fatuous Mr. Tasbro was keeping his mouth shut when, toward the end of June, a newspaper man at Baddington, Vermont, was suddenly arrested as editor of Vermont Vigilance and author of all the pamphlets by Doremus and Lorinda. He went to concentration camp. Buck and Dan Wilgus and Sissy prevented Doremus from confessing and from even going to call on the victim, and when, with Lorinda no longer there as confidant, Doremus tried to explain it all to Emma, she said, "Wasn't it lucky that the government had blamed somebody else?" Emma had worked out the theory that the NU activity was some sort of a naughty game which kept her boy Doremus busy after his retirement. He was mildly nagging the corpos. She wasn't sure that it was really nice to nag the legal authorities, but still, for a little fellow, her Doremus had always been surprisingly spunky, just like, she often confided to Sissy, a spunky little Scotch terrier she had owned when she was a girl. Mr. McNabbit, its name had been. A little Scotch terrier, but my, so spunky he acted like he was a regular lion. She was rather glad that Lorinda was gone, though she liked Lorinda and worried about how well she might do with a tea room in a new town, a town where she had never lived. But she just couldn't help feeling, she confided not only to Sissy but to Mary and Buck, that Lorinda, with all her wild crazy ideas about women's rights and workmen being just as good as their employers, had a bad influence on Doremus's tendency to show off and shock people. She mildly wondered why Buck and Sissy snorted so. She hadn't meant to say anything particularly funny. For too many years, she had been used to Doremus's irregular routine to have her sleep disturbed by his returning from Buck's at the improper time to which she referred as at all hours. But she did wish he would be more on time for his meals, and she gave up the question of why, these days, he seemed to like to associate with ordinary people like John Polycop, Dan Wilgus, Daniel Babcock, and Pete Vuitton. My, some people said Pete couldn't even read and write, and Doremus so educated and all. Why didn't he see more of lovely people like Frank Tasbro and Professor Staubmeyer and Mr. R.C. Crowley and this new friend of his, the Honorable John Sullivan Reek? Why couldn't he keep out of politics? She'd always said they were no occupation for a gentleman. Like David, now 10 years old, and like 20 or 30 million other Americans from 1 to 100, but all of the same mental age, Emma thought the marching MMs were a very fine show indeed, so much like movies of the Civil War, really quite educational. And while, of course, if Doremus didn't care for President Windrip, she was opposed to him also, yet didn't Mr. Windrip speak beautifully about pure language, church attendance, low taxation, and the American flag? The realists, the makers of omelets, did climb, as Tasbro had predicted. Colonel Dewey Hake, Commissioner of the Northeastern Province, became Secretary of War and High Marshal of MMs, while the former Secretary, Colonel Luthorne, retired to Kansas and the real estate business, and was well spoken of by all businessmen for being thus willing to give up the grandeur of Washington for duty toward practical affairs and his family, who were throughout the press depicted as having frequently missed him. It was rumored in NU cells that Hake might go higher even than Secretary of War, that Winthrop was worried by the forced growth of a certain effeminacy in Lee Saracen under the arc light of glory. Francis Tasbrough was elevated to district commissionership at Hanover, but Mr. Sullivan Reek did not, in series, go on to be provincial commissioner. It was said that he had too many friends among just the old-line politicians whose jobs the corpos were so enthusiastically taking. No, the new provincial commissioner, viceroy and general, was military judge Effingham Swan, the one man whom Mary Jessup Greenhill hated more than she did Shad Ledoux. Swan was a splendid commissioner. Within 3 days after taking office, he had John Sullivan Reek and 7 assistant district commissioners arrested, tried, and imprisoned, all within 24 hours, and an 80-year-old woman, mother of a new underground agent but not otherwise accused of wickedness, penned in a concentration camp for the more desperate traitors. It was in a disused quarry, which was always a foot deep in water. After he had sentenced her, Swan was said to have bowed to her most courteously. The new underground sent out warning from headquarters in Montreal for a general tightening up of precautions against being caught distributing propaganda. Agents were disappearing rather alarmingly. Buck scoffed, but Doremus was nervous. He noticed that the same strange man, ostensibly a drummer, a large man with unpleasant eyes, had twice got into conversation with him in the Hotel Wessex lobby, and too obviously hinted that he was anti-corpo, and would love to have Doremus say something nasty about the chief and the MMs. Doremus became cautious about going out to Buck's. He parked his car in 6 different wood roads and crept afoot to the secret basement. On the evening of the 28th of June, 1938, he had a notion that he was being followed. So closely did a car with red-tinted headlights, anxiously watched in his rearview mirror, stick behind him as he took the Keesmet Highway down to Buck's. He turned up a side road, down another. The spy car followed. He stopped in a driveway on the left-hand side of the road and angrily stepped out, in time to see the other car pass, with a man who looked like Shad Ledoux driving. He swung round then and, without concealment, bolted for Buck's. In the basement, Buck was contentedly tying up bundles of the vigilance, while Father Perifix, in his shirt sleeves, vest open and black dickie swinging beneath his reversed collar, sat at a plain pine table, writing a warning to New England Catholics that though the corpos had, unlike the Nazis in Germany, been shrewd enough to flatter prelates, they had lowered the wages of French-Canadian Catholic millhands and imprisoned their leaders just as severely as in the case of the avowedly wicked Protestants. Perifix smiled up at Doremus, stretched, lighted a pipe, and chuckled, "As a great ecclesiast, Doremus, is it your opinion that I shall be committing a venial or a mortal sin by publishing this little masterpiece, the work of my favorite author, without the bishop's imprimatur?" "Stephen, Buck, I think they're on to us. Maybe we've got to fold up already and get the press and type out of here." He told of being shadowed. He telephoned to Julian at MM headquarters, and, since there were too many French-Canadian inspectors about for him to dare to use his brand of French, he telephoned in the fine new German he had been learning by translation. "Denkst du, ihr Freunds der, habe na Idee die letzte Tag von wat wir mach hier?" And the college-bred Julian had so much international culture as to be able to answer, "Ja, ich meine ihr was sagen morning free. Look out." How could they move? Where? Dan Wilgus arrived in panic an hour after.
"Say, they're watching us."
Doremus, Buck, and the priest gathered round the black Viking of a man.
Just now, when I came in, I thought I heard something in the bushes here in the yard near the house. And before I thought, I flashed my torch on him, and by golly, if it wasn't Eris Dilly, and not in uniform. And you know how Eris loves his god... Excuse me, Father. How he loves his uniform. He was disguised. Sure, in overalls. Looked like a jackass that's gone under a clothesline. Well, he'd been rubbering at the house. Of course, these curtains are drawn, but I don't know what he saw, and... The three large men looked to Doremus for orders. We've got to get all this stuff out of here. Quick, take it and hide it in Truman Webb's attic. Stephen, get John Polycop and Mungo Kitterick and Pete Vutong on the phone. Get him here, quick. Tell John to stop by and tell Julian to come as soon as he can. Dan, start dismantling the press. Buck, bundle up all the literature. As he spoke, Doremus was wrapping type in scraps of newspaper. And at 3 next morning, before light, Polycop was driving toward Truman Webb's farmhouse the entire equipment of the new underground printing establishment in Buck's old farm truck, from which blatted, for the benefit of all ears that might be concerned, 2 frightened calves. Next day, Julian ventured to invite his superior officers, Shad Ledoux and Emil Staubmeier, to a poker session at Buck's. They came with alacrity. They found Buck, Doremus, Mungo Kitterick, and Doc Itchett, the last an entirely innocent participant in certain deceptions. They played in Buck's parlor, but during the evening Buck announced that anyone wanting beer instead of whiskey would find it in a tub of ice in the basement, and that anyone wishing to wash his hands would find 2 bathrooms upstairs. Shad hastily went for beer. Doc Itchett, even more hastily, went to wash his hands. Both of them were gone much longer than one would have expected. When the party broke up and Buck and Doremus were alone, Buck shrieked with bucolic mirth. I could scarcely keep a straight face when I heard good old Shad opening the cupboards and taking a fine long look-see for pamphlets down in the basement. Well, Captain Jessup, that about ends their suspicion of this place as a den of traitors, I guess. God, but isn't Shad dumb? This was at perhaps 3 a.m. on the morning of June 30th. Doremus stayed home, writing sedition all the afternoon and evening of the 30th, hiding the sheets under pages of newspaper in the Franklin stove in his study, so that he could touch them off with a match in case of a raid, a trick he had learned from Carl Billinger's anti-Nazi Fatherland. This new opus was devoted to murders ordered by Commissioner Effingham Swan. On the 1st and 2nd of July, when he sauntered uptown, he was rather noticeably encountered by the same weighty drummer who had picked him up in the Hotel Wessex lobby before, and who now insisted on their having a drink together. Doremus escaped and was conscious that he was being followed by an unknown young man, flamboyant in an apricot-colored polo shirt and gray bags, whom he recognized as having worn MM uniform at a parade in June. On July 3rd, rather panicky, Doremus drove to Truman Webb's, taking an hour of zigzagging to do it, and warned Truman not to permit any more printing till he should have a release. When Doremus went home, Sissy likely informed him that Shad had insisted she go out to an MM picnic with him on the next afternoon, the 4th, and that, information or no, she had refused. She was afraid of him, surrounded by his ready playmates. That night of the 3rd, Doremus slept only in 6 spasms. He was reasonlessly convinced that he would be arrested before dawn. The night was overcast and electric and uneasy. The crickets sounded as though they were piping under compulsion, in a rhythm of terror. He lay throbbing to their sound. He wanted to flee, but how and where, and how could he leave his threatened family? For the first time in years, he wished that he were sleeping beside the unperturbable Emma, beside her small, earthy hillock of body. He laughed at himself. What could Emma do to protect him against minutemen? Just scream. And what then? But he, who always slept with his door shut to protect his sacred aloneness, popped out of bed to open the door, that he might have the comfort of hearing her breathe, and the fiercer Mary stir in slumber, and Sissy's occasional young whimper.
He was awakened before dawn by early firecrackers. He heard the tramping of feet. He lay taut. Then he awoke again at 7:30 and was slightly angry that nothing happened. The MMs brought out their burnished helmets and all the rideable horses in the neighborhood, some of them known as most superior plow horses, for the great celebration of the new freedom on the morning of 4th of July. There was no post of the American Legion in the jaunty parade. That organization had been completely suppressed, and a number of American Legion leaders had been shot. Others had tactfully taken posts in the MM itself. The troops, in Hollow Square, with the ordinary citizenry humbly jammed in behind them and the Jessup family rather hoity-toity on the outskirts, were addressed by ex-governor Isham Hubbard, a fine, ruddy old rooster who could say cock-a-doodle-doo with more profundity than any fowl since Aesop. He announced that the chief had extraordinary resemblances to Washington, Jefferson, and William B. McKinley, and to Napoleon on his better days. The trumpets blew, the MMs gallantly marched off nowhere in particular, and Doremus went home, feeling much better after his laugh. Following noon dinner, since it was raining, he proposed a game of contract to Emma, Mary, and Sissy, with Mrs. Candy as volunteer umpire. But the thunder of the hill country disquieted him. Whenever he was dummy, he ambled to a window. The rain ceased, the sun came out for a false, hesitating moment, and the wet grass looked unreal. Clouds with torn bottoms like the hem of a ragged skirt were driven down the valley, cutting off the bulk of Mount Faithful. The sun went out as in a mammoth catastrophe, and instantly the world was in unholy darkness which poured into the room.
"Why, it's quite dark, isn't it? Sissy, turn on the lights," said Emma.
The rain attacked again in a crash, and to Doremus, looking out, the whole knowable world seemed washed out. Through the deluge he saw a huge car flash, the great wheels throwing up fountains. "Wonder what make of car that is. Must be a 16-cylinder Cadillac, I guess," reflected Doremus. The car swerved into his own gateway, almost knocking down a gatepost, and stopped with a jar at his porch. From it leaped 5 Minutemen, black waterproof capes over their uniforms. Before he could quite get through the reflection that he recognized none of them, they were there in the room. The leader, an ensign, and most certainly Doremus did not recognize him, marched up to Doremus, looked at him casually, and struck him full in the face. Except for the one light pink of the bayonet when he had been arrested before, except for an occasional toothache or headache or a smart when he had banged a fingernail, Doremus Jessup had not for 30 years known authentic pain. It was as incredible as it was horrifying, this torture in his eyes and nose and crushed mouth. He stood bent, gasping, and the ensign again smashed his face and observed, "You are under arrest." Mary had launched herself on the ensign, was hitting at him with a china ashtray. 2 MMs dragged her off, threw her on the couch, and one of them pinned her there. The other 2 guards were bulking over the paralyzed Emma, the galvanized Sissy. Doremus vomited suddenly and collapsed, as though he were dead drunk. He was conscious that the 5 MMs were yanking the books from the shelves and hurling them on the floor so that the covers split, and with their pistol butts smashing vases and lampshades and small occasional tables. One of them tattooed a rough MM on the white paneling above the fireplace with shots from his automatic. The ensign said only, "Careful, Jim," and kissed the hysterical Sissy. Doremus struggled to get up. An MM kicked him in the elbow. It felt like death itself, and Doremus writhed on the floor. He heard them tramping upstairs. He remembered then that his manuscript about the murders by Provincial Commissioner Effingham Swan was hidden in the Franklin stove in his study. The sound of their smashing of furniture in the bedrooms on the 2nd floor was like that of 12 woodchoppers gone mad. In all his agony, Doremus struggled to get up, to set fire to the papers in the stove before they should be found. He tried to look at his women, He could make out Mary, tied to the couch. When had that ever happened? But his vision was too blurred, his mind too bruised, to see anything clearly. Staggering, sometimes creeping on his hands and knees, he did actually get past the men in the bedrooms and up the stairs to the third floor and his study. He was in time to see the ensign throwing his best-beloved books and his letter files, accumulated these 20 years, out of the study window, and to see him search the papers in the Franklin stove, look up with cheerful triumph, and cackle, "Nice piece you've written here, I guess, Jessup. Commissioner Swan will love to see it." "I demand see Commissioner Ledoux, District Commissioner Tasbro, friends of mine," stammered Doremus. "Don't know a thing about them. I'm running this show," the ensign chuckled, and slapped Doremus, not very painfully, merely with a shamefulness as great as Doremus's when he realized that he had been so cowardly as to appeal to Shad and Francis. He did not open his mouth again, did not whimper nor even amuse the troopers by vainly appealing on behalf of the women, as he was hustled down 2 flights of stairs. They threw him down the lower flight, and he landed on his raw shoulder, and out to the big car. The MM driver, who had been waiting behind the wheel, already had the engine running. The car whined away, threatening every instant to skid. But the Doremus who had been queasy about skidding did not notice. What could he do about it anyway? He was helpless between 2 troopers in the back seat, and his powerlessness to make the driver slow up seemed part of all his powerlessness before the dictator's power. He who had always so taken it for granted that in his dignity and social security he was just slightly superior to laws and judges and policemen, to all the risks and pain of ordinary workers. He was unloaded like a balky mule at the jail entrance of the courthouse. He resolved that when he was led before Shad, he would so rebuke the scoundrel that he would not forget it. But Doremus was not taken into the courthouse. He was kicked toward a large, black-painted, unlettered truck by the entrance, literally kicked, while even in his bewildered anguish he speculated, "I wonder which is worse, the physical pain of being kicked or the mental humiliation of being turned into a slave?" "Hell, don't be sophistical. It's the pain in the behind that hurts most." He was hiked up a stepladder into the back of the truck. From the unlighted interior, a moan. "My God, not you too, Dormouse." It was the voice of Buck Titus, and with him as prisoners were Truman Webb and Dan Wilgus. Dan was in handcuffs, because he had fought so. The 4 men were too sore to talk much as they felt the truck lurch away and they were thrown against one another. Once Doremus spoke truthfully, "I don't know how to tell you how ghastly sorry I am to have got you into this." And once he lied when Buck groaned, "Did those blank blank hurt the girls?" They must have ridden for 3 hours. Doremus was in such a coma of suffering that even though his back winced as it bounced against the rough floor, and his face was all one neuralgia, he drowsed and woke to terror, drowsed and woke to his own helpless wailing. The truck stopped. The doors were opened on lights thick among white brick buildings. He hazily saw that they were on the one-time Dartmouth campus, headquarters now of the Corpo District Commissioner. That commissioner was his old acquaintance, Francis Tasbro. He would be released. They would be freed, all 4. The incredulity of his humiliation cleared away. He came out of his sick fear like a shipwrecked man sighting an approaching boat. But he did not see Tasbro. The MM's silence, save for mechanical cursing, drove him into a hallway, into a cell which had once been part of a sedate classroom, left him with a final clout on the head. He dropped on a wooden pallet with a straw pillow and was instantly asleep. He was too dazed, he who usually looked recordingly at places, to note then or afterward what his cell was like, except that it appeared to be filled with sulfuric fumes from a locomotive engine. When he came to, his face seemed frozen stiff. His coat was torn and foul with the smell of vomit. He felt degraded, as though he had done something shameful. His door was violently opened. A dirt-clotted bowl of feeble coffee with a crust of bread faintly smeared with oleomargarine was thrust at him, and after he had given them up, nauseated, he was marched out into the corridor by two guards, just as he wanted to go to the toilet. Even that he could forget in the paralysis of fear. One guard seized him by the trim small beard and yanked it, laughing very much.
"Always did want to see whether a billy goat whisker would pull out or not," snickered the guard.
While he was thus tormented, Doremus received a crack behind his ear from the other man, and a scolding command, "Come on, goat! Want us to milk you? You dirty little so-and-so! What you in for? You look like a little kite tailor, you little..."
"Him!" the other scoffed. "Nah, he's some kind of a half-eared hick newspaper editor. They'll sure shoot him, sedition. But I hope they'll beat hell out of him first for being such a bum editor."
"Him, an editor? Say, listen, I got a swell idea. Hey, fellas!"
Four or five other MMs, half-dressed, looked out from a room down the hall.
"This here is a writing fellow. I'm gonna make him show us how he writes. Look it."
The guard dashed down the corridor to a door with the sign "Gents" hung out in front of it, came back with paper, not clean, threw it in front of Doremus and yammered, "Come on, boss. Show us how you write your pieces. Come on, write us a piece with your nose." He was iron strong. He pressed Doremus's nose down against the filthy paper and held it there, while his mates giggled. They were interrupted by an officer, commanding, though leniently,
"Come on, boys, cut out the monkey shines and take this blank to the bullpen. Trial this morning."
Doremus was led to a dirty room in which half a dozen prisoners were waiting. One of them was Buck Titus. Over one eye, Buck had a slatternly bandage which had so loosened as to show that his forehead was cut to the bone. Buck managed to wink jovially. Doremus tried, vainly, to keep from sobbing. He waited an hour, standing, arms tight at his side, at the demands of an ugly-faced guard, snapping a dog whip with which he twice slashed Doremus when his hands fell lax. Buck was led into the trial room just before him. The door was closed. Doremus heard Buck cry out terribly, as though he had been wounded to death. The cry faded into a choked gasping. When Buck was led out of the inner room, his face was as dirty and as pale as his bandage, over which blood was now creeping. The man at the door of the inner room jerked his thumb sharply at Doremus and snarled, "You're next." Now he would face Tasbro. But in the small room into which he had been taken, and he was confused because somehow he had expected a large courtroom, there was only the ensign who had arrested him yesterday sitting at a table, running through papers, while a stolid MM stood on either side of him, rigid, hand on pistol holster. The ensign kept him waiting, then snapped with disheartening suddenness, "Your name?"
"You know it."
The two guards beside Doremus each hit him. "Your name?"
"Doremus Jessup."
"You're a communist."
"No, I'm not."
"25 lashes, and the oil."
Not believing, not understanding, Doremus was rushed across the room into a cellar beyond. A long wooden table there was dark with dry blood, stank with dry blood. The guards seized Doremus, sharply jerked his head back, pried open his jaws, and poured in a quart of castor oil. They tore off his garments above the belt, flung them on the sticky floor. They threw him face downward on the long table, and began to lash him with a one-piece steel fishing rod. Each stroke cut into the flesh of his back, and they beat him slowly, relishing it, to keep him from fainting too quickly. But he was unconscious when, to the guard's great diversion, the castor oil took effect. Indeed, he did not know it till he found himself limp on a messy piece of gunny sacking on the floor of his cell. They awakened him twice during the night to demand, "You're a communist, eh? You better admit it.
We're going to beat the living tar out of you till you do.
Though he was sicker than he had ever been in his life, yet he was also angrier. Too angry to admit anything whatever, even to save his wrecked life. He simply snarled, "No." But on the third beating, he savagely wondered if "no" was now a truthful answer. After each questioning, he was pounded again with fists, but not lashed with the steel rod, because the headquarters doctor had forbidden it. He was a sporty-looking young doctor in plus-fours. He yawned at the guards in the blood-reeking cellar.
"Better cut out the lashes, or this blank will pass out on you."
Doremus raised his head from the table to gasp, "You call yourself a doctor, and you associate with these murderers?"
"Oh, shut up, you little blank. Dirty traitors like you deserve to be beaten to death, and maybe you will be, but I think the boys ought to save you for the trial."
The doctor showed his scientific mettle by twisting Doremus's ear till it felt as though it were torn off, chuckled, "Go to it, boys," and ambled away, ostentatiously humming. For 3 nights he was questioned and lashed, once, late at night, by guards who complained of the inhuman callousness of their officers in making them work so late. They amused themselves by using an old harness strap with a buckle on it to beat him. He almost broke down when the examining ensign declared that Buck Titus had confessed their illegal propaganda and narrated so many details of the work that Doremus could almost have believed in the confession. He did not listen. He told himself, "No. Buck would die before he'd confess anything. It's all Eris Dilly's spying." The ensign cooed, "Now, if you'll just have the sense to copy your friend Titus and tell us who's in the conspiracy besides him and you and Wilgus and Webb, we'll let you go. We know, all right. Oh, we know the whole plot. But we just want to find out whether you've finally come to your senses and been converted, my little friend. Now, who else was there? Just give us their names. We'll let you go. Or would you like the castor oil and the whip again?" Doremus did not answer. 10 lashes, said the ensign. He was chased out for half an hour's walk on the campus every afternoon, probably because he would have preferred lying on his hard cot, trying to keep still enough so that his heart would stop its deathly hammering. 100 prisoners marched there, round and round, senselessly. He passed Buck Titus. To salute him would have meant a blow from the guards. They greeted each other with quick eyelids, and when he saw those untroubled spaniel eyes, Doremus knew that Buck had not squealed. And in the exercise yard he saw Dan Wilgus, but Dan was not walking free. He was led out from the torture rooms by guards, and with his crushed nose, his flattened ear, he looked as though he had been pounded by a prize fighter. He seemed partly paralyzed. Doremus tried to get information about Dan from a guard in his cell corridor. The guard, a handsome, clear-cheeked young man, noted in a valley of the White Mountains as a local beau and very kind to his mother, laughed, Oh, your friend Wilgus? That chump thinks he can lick his weight in wildcats. I hear he always tries to soak the guards. They'll take that out of him, all right." Doremus thought, that night, he could not be sure, but he thought he heard Dan wailing half the night. Next morning he was told that Dan, who had always been so disgusted when he had had to set up the news of a weakling's suicide, had hanged himself in his cell. Then, unexpectedly, Doremus was taken into a room, this time reasonably large, a former English classroom turned into a court, for his trial. But it was not District Commissioner Francis Tasbro who was on the bench, nor any military judge, but no less a protector of the people than the great new provincial commissioner, Effingham Swan. Swan was looking at Doremus's article about him as Doremus was led up to stand before the bench. He spoke, and this harsh, tired-looking man was no longer the airy Rhodes scholar who had sported with Doremus once like a boy pulling the wings off flies.
"Jessup, you plead guilty to seditious activities?"
"Why,
Doremus looked helplessly about for something in the way of legal counsel.
"Commissioner Tasbro," called Swan.
So at last Doremus did see his boyhood playmate. Tasbro did nothing so commendable as to avoid Doremus's eyes. Indeed, he looked at Doremus directly and most affably as he spoke his piece.
"Your Excellency, it gives me great pain to have to expose this man, Jessup, whom I've known all my life and tried to help, but he always was a smart aleck. He was a laughingstock in Fort Beulah for the way he tried to show off as a great political leader. And when the chief was elected, he was angry because he didn't get any political office, and he went about everywhere trying to disaffect people. I have heard him do so myself."
"That's enough, thanks, County Commissioner Ledoux. Captain Ledoux, is it or is it not true that the man Jessup tried to persuade you to join a violent plot against my person?" But Shad did not look at Doremus as he mumbled, "It's true." Swan crackled, "Gentlemen, I think that that, plus the evidence contained in the prisoner's own manuscript, which I hold here, is sufficient testimony. Prisoner, if it weren't for your age and your damn silly senile weakness, I'd sentence you to 100 lashes, as I do all the other communists like you that threaten the corporate state. As it is, I sentence you to be held in concentration camp at the will of the court, but with a minimum sentence of 17 years. Doremus calculated rapidly. He was 62 now. He would be 79 then. He never would see freedom again. "And in the power of issuing emergency decrees conferred upon me as provincial commissioner, I also sentence you to death by shooting. But I suspend that sentence, though only until such time as you may be caught trying to escape. And I hope you'll have just lots and lots of time in prison, Jessup, to think about how clever you were in this entrancing article you wrote about me, and to remember that any nasty cold morning they may take you out in the rain and shoot you." He ended with a mild suggestion to the guards. "And 20 lashes. 2 minutes later they had forced castor oil down him. He lay trying to bite at the stained wood of the whipping table, and he could hear the whish of the steel fishing rod as a guard playfully tried it out in the air before bringing it down across the criss-cross wounds of his raw back. Chapter 31. As the open prison van approached the concentration camp at Trianon, the last light of afternoon caressed the thick birch and maples and poplars up the pyramid of Mount Faithful. But the grayness swiftly climbed the slope, and all the valley was left in cold shadow. In his seat, the sick Doremus drooped again in listlessness. The prim Georgian buildings of the girls' school, which had been turned into a concentration camp at Trianon, 9 miles north of Fort Beulah, had been worse used than Dartmouth, where whole buildings were reserved for the luxuries of the corpos and their female cousins, all very snotty and parvenu. The Trianon school seemed to have been gouged by a flood. Marble doorsteps had been taken away. One of them now graced the residence of the wife of the superintendent, Mrs. Cowlick, a woman fat, irate, jeweled, religious, and given to announcing that all opponents of the chief were communists and ought to be shot offhand. Windows were smashed. "Hurrah for the chief" had been chalked on brick walls, and other chalked words, each of 4 letters, had been rubbed out, not very thoroughly. The lawns and hollyhock beds were a mess of weeds. The buildings stood on 3 sides of a square. The 4th side and the gaps between buildings were closed with unpainted pine fences topped with strands of barbed wire. Every room except the office of Captain Cowlick, the superintendent — he was as near nothing at all as any man can be who has attained to such honors as being a captain in the quartermaster corps and the head of a prison — was smeared with filth. His office was merely dreary and scented with whiskey, not, like the other rooms, with ammonia. Cowlick was not too ill-natured. He wished that the camp guards, all MMs, would not treat the prisoners viciously, except when they tried to escape. But he was a mild man, much too mild to hurt the feelings of the MMs and perhaps set up inhibitions in their psyches by interfering with their methods of discipline. The poor fellows probably meant well when they lashed noisy inmates for insisting they had committed no crime. And the good cowlick saved Doremus's life for a while, let him lie for a month in the stuffy hospital, and have actual beef in his daily beef stew. The prison doctor, a decayed old drunkard who had had his medical training in the late 80s, and who had been somewhat close to trouble in civil life for having performed too many abortions, was also good-natured enough, when sober, and at last he permitted Doremus to have Dr. Marcus Olmsted in from Fort Beulah. And for the first time in 4 weeks, Doremus had news, any news whatsoever, of the world beyond prison. Where in normal life it would have been agony to wait for 1 hour to know what might be happening to his friends, his family, now for 1 month he had not known whether they were alive or dead. Dr. Olmsted, as guilty as Doremus himself of what the corpos called treason, dared speak to him only a moment, because the prison doctor stayed in the hospital ward all the while, drooling over whip-scarred patients and daubing iodine more or less near their wounds. Olmsted sat on the edge of his cot with its foul blankets, unwashed for months, and muttered rapidly, "Quick, listen, don't talk. Mrs. Jessup and your two girls are all right. They're scared, but no signs of their being arrested. Here Lorinda Pike is all right. Your grandson, David, looks fine, though I'm afraid he'll grow up a corpo like all the youngsters. Buck Titus is alive at another concentration camp, the one near Woodstock. Our NU cell at Fort Beulah is doing what it can. No publishing, but we forward information. Get a lot from Julian Falk. Great joke. He's been promoted, MM squad leader now. Mary and Sissy and Father Perifix keep distributing pamphlets from Boston. They help the Quinn boy, my driver, and me to forward refugees to Canada. Yes, we carry on. About like an oxygen tent for a patient that's dying of pneumonia. It hurts to see you looking like a ghost, Doremus. But you'll pull through. You've got pretty good nerves for a little cuss. That aged-in-the-keg prison doctor is looking this way. Bye. He was not permitted to see Dr. Olmsted again, but it was probably Olmsted's influence that got him when he was dismissed from the hospital, still shaky but well enough to stumble about, a vastly desirable job as sweeper of cells and corridors, cleaner of lavatories and scrubber of toilets, instead of working in the Woods gang up Mount Faithful, where old men who sank under the weight of logs were said to be hammered to death by guards under the sadistic Ensign Stoit, when Captain Cowlick wasn't looking. It was better, too, than the undesirable idleness of being disciplined in the doghouse, where you lay naked in darkness, and where bad cases were reformed by being kept awake for 48 or even 96 hours. Doremus was a conscientious toilet cleaner. He didn't like the work very much, but he had pride in being able to scrub as skillfully as any professional pearl diver in a Greek lunchroom, and satisfaction in lessening a little the wretchedness of his imprisoned comrades by giving them clean floors. For, he told himself, they were his comrades. He saw that he, who had thought of himself as a capitalist because he could hire and fire, and because theoretically he owned his business, had been as helpless as the most itinerant janitor once it seemed worthwhile to the big business which corpoism represented to get rid of him. Yet he still told himself stoutly that he did not believe in a dictatorship of the proletariat any more than he believed in a dictatorship of the bankers and utility owners. He still insisted that any doctor or preacher, though economically he might be as insecure as the humblest of his flock, who did not feel that he was a little better than they and privileged to enjoy working a little harder, was a rotten doctor or a preacher without grace. He felt that he himself had been a better and more honorable reporter than Doc Itchett, and a thundering sight better student of politics than most of his shopkeeper and farmer and factory worker readers. Yet bourgeois pride was so gone out of him that he was flattered, a little thrilled, when he was universally called Doremus and not Mr. Jessup by farmer and workman and truck driver and plain hobo. When they thought enough of his courage under beating and his good temper under being crowded with others in a narrow cell, to regard him as almost as good as their own virile selves. Carl Pascal mocked him. "I told you so, Doremus. You'll be a communist yet." "Yes, maybe I will, Carl, after you communists kick out all your false prophets and bellyachers and power drunkards, and all your press agents for the Moscow subway. Well, all right, why don't you join Max Eastman? I hear he's escaped to Mexico and has a whole big, pure, Trotskyite communist party of 17 members there."
17? Too many. What I want is mass action by just one member, alone on a hilltop. I'm a great optimist, Carl. I still hope America may someday rise to the standards of Kit Carson.
As sweeper and scrubber, Doremus had unusual chances for gossip with other prisoners. He chuckled when he thought of how many of his fellow criminals were acquaintances. Carl Pascal, Henry Veder, his own cousin, Louis Rotenstern, who looked now like a corpse, unforgettingly wounded in his old pride of having become a real American, Cliff Little, the jeweler, who was dying of consumption, Ben Tripper, who had been the jolliest workman in Madary Cole's grist mill, Professor Victor Loveland of the defunct Isaiah College, and Raymond Pridewell, that old Tory who was still so contemptuous of flattery, so clean amid dirt, so hawk-eyed, that the guards were uncomfortable when they beat him. Pascal, the communist, Pridewell, the squire-archy Republican, and Henry Veder, who had never cared a hang about politics, and who had recovered from the first shocks of imprisonment, these three had become intimates because they had more arrogance of utter courage than anyone else in the prison. For home, Doremus shared with five other men a cell 12 feet by 10 and 8 feet high, which a finishing schoolgirl had once considered outrageously confined for one lone young woman. Here they slept in 2 tiers of 3 bunks each. Here they ate, washed, played cards, read, and enjoyed the leisurely contemplation which, as Captain Cowlick preached to them every Sunday morning, was to reform their black souls and turn them into loyal corpos. None of them, certainly not Doremus, complained much. They got used to sleeping in a jelly of tobacco smoke and human stench, to eating stews that always left them nervously hungry, to having no more dignity or freedom than monkeys in a cage, as a man gets used to the indignity of having to endure cancer. Only it left in them a murderous hatred of their oppressors, so that they, men of peace, all of them, would gladly have hanged every corpo, mild or vicious. Doremus understood John Brown much better. His cellmates were Carl Pascal, Henry Veder, and 3 men whom he had not known, a Boston architect, a farmhand, and a dope fiend who had once kept questionable restaurants. They had good talk, especially from the dope fiend, who placidly defended crime in a world where the only real crime had been poverty. The worst torture to Doremus, aside from the agony of actual floggings, was the waiting. The waiting. It became a distinct, tangible thing, as individual and real as bread or water. How long would he be in? How long would he be in? Night and day, asleep and waking, he worried it, and by his bunk saw waiting the figure of waiting, a gray, foul ghost. It was like waiting in a filthy station for a late train, not for hours, but for months. Would Swan amuse himself by having Doremus taken out and shot? He could not care much now. He could not picture it any more than he could picture kissing Lorinda, walking through the woods with Buck, playing with David and Foolish, or anything less sensual than the ever-derisive visions of roast beef with gravy, of a hot bath, last and richest of luxuries, where their only way of washing, except for a fortnightly shower, was with a dirty shirt dipped in the one basin of cold water for 6 men. Besides waiting, one other ghost hung about them, the notion of escaping. It was of that, far more than of the beastliness and idiocy of the corpos, that they whispered in the cell at night. When to escape, how to escape, to sneak off through the bushes when they were out with the woods gang, by some magic to cut through the bars on their cell window and drop out and blessedly not be seen by the patrols, to manage to hang on underneath one of the prison trucks and be driven away, a childish fantasy. They longed for escape as hysterically and as often as a politician longs for votes. But they had to discuss it cautiously, for there were stool pigeons all over the prison. This was hard for Doremus to believe. He could not understand a man's betraying his companions, and he did not believe it till, 2 months after Doremus had gone to concentration camp, Clifford Little betrayed to the guards Henry Veder's plan to escape in a hay wagon. Henry was properly dealt with. Little was released. And Doremus, it may be, suffered over it nearly as much as either of them, sturdily though he tried to argue that Little had tuberculosis, and that the often beatings had bled out his soul. Each prisoner was permitted one visitor a fortnight, and in sequence Doremus saw Emma, Mary, Sissy, David. But always an M.M. was standing 2 feet away, listening, and Doremus had from them nothing more than a fluttering, "We're all fine. We hear Buck is all right. We hear Lorinda is doing fine in her new tea room. Philip writes he is all right." And once came Philip himself, his pompous son, more pompous than ever now as a corpo judge, and very hurt about his father's insane radicalism. Considerably more hurt when Doremus tartly observed that he would much rather have had the dog Foolish for visitor. And there were letters, all censored, worse than useless to a man who had been so glad to hear the living voices of his friends. In the long run, these frustrate visits, these empty letters, made his waiting the more dismal, because they suggested that perhaps he was wrong in his nightly visions. Perhaps the world outside was not so loving and eager and adventurous as he remembered it, but only dreary as his cell. He had little known Karl Pascal, yet now the argumentative Marxian was his nearest friend, his one amusing consolation. Karl could and did prove that the trouble with leaky valves, sour cow pastures, the teaching of calculus, and all novels was their failure to be guided by the writings of Lenin. In his new friendship, Doremus was old maidishly agitated, lest Karl be taken out and shot, the recognition usually given to communists. He discovered that he need not worry. Karl had been in jail before. He was the trained agitator for whom Doremus had longed in New Underground days. He had ferreted out so many scandals about the financial and sexual shenanigans of every one of the guards that they were afraid that even while he was being shot he might tattle to the firing squad. They were much more anxious for his good opinion than for that of Captain Cowlick, and they timidly brought him little presents of chewing tobacco and Canadian newspapers, as though they were school children honeying up to teacher. When Aristilli was transferred from night patrols in Fort Beulah to the position of guard at Trianon, a reward for having given to Shad Ledoux certain information about R.C. Crowley, which cost that banker hundreds of dollars, Aris, that slinker, that able snooper, jumped at the sight of Karl and began to look pious and kind. He had known Karl before. Despite the presence of Stoit, ensign of guards, an ex-cashier who had once enjoyed shooting dogs, and who now, in the blessed escape of corpoism, enjoyed lashing human beings, the camp at Trianon was not so cruel as the district prison at Hanover. But from the dirty window of his cell, Doremus saw horrors enough. One mid-morning, a radiant September morning with the air already savoring the peace of autumn, he saw the firing squad marching out his cousin, Henry Veder, who had recently tried to escape. Henry had been a granite monolith of a man. He had walked like a soldier. He had in his cell been proud of shaving every morning, as once he had done, with the tin basin of water heated on the stove in the kitchen of his old white house up on Mount Terror. Now he stooped, and toward death he walked with dragging feet. His face of a Roman senator was smeared from the cow dung into which they had flung him for his last slumber. As they tramped out through the quadrangle gate, Ensign Stoit, commanding the squad, halted Henry, laughed at him, and calmly kicked him in the groin.